Article 6 of the Constitution provides for the transitional arrangement. It specifically provides that all law that was in force when the new Constitution took effect continues in force subject to any amendment or repeal or consistency with the Constitution. In other words, Section 228, even though there is a new Constitution, remains in effect unless amended or repealed. I repeat again, which has not happened. Specifically, Clause 24.1 of Schedule 6 of the Constitution provides that Section 228 of the Interim Constitution, among others, continue to be enforced as if the provisions of these rules and resolutions of the Council... I think I'm confusing myself here, just a minute. Continues as if the previous constitution had not been repealed, subject to amendment or repeal or its consistency with the constitution. The only way we can avoid 228 in the current situation is if we find it to be inconsistent with the constitution. Schedule 6 of the constitution may be repealed or amended in terms of a procedure set out in section 75 of the constitution, as opposed to a constitutional amendment process. And I think, Chair, I need to emphasize this, because it is a novelty. Schedule 6 specifically says Section 228 can be amended or repealed by a Section 75 bill, which is unusual for a constitution to be amended by an Act of Parliament. It's normally amended in the constitution. Members will recall that once the new constitution was passed in 1996, the interim constitution assumed a status of a normal act of parliament, which is why it can be amended by an act of parliament in terms of section 75. We proceed, Chair, to go to the joint rules. Joint rule 120A provides for the establishment of the JSCD. Now, this compounds the problem. Because now it's not only Section 228 and Schedule 6. Parliament on its own, in its own rules, establishes the Joint Standing Committee on Defence. It states that there is a JSCD as required by Section 228(3) of the Constitution. In other words, it reaffirms Section 228(6). And it goes on to describe the functions, and it uses exactly the language that is used in Section 228. And it reads, the JSCD investigates and makes recommendations regarding the budget, functioning, organization, armaments, policy, morale, and state of preparedness of the National Defense Force, and performs such other functions relating to the parliamentary supervision of the forces as may be prescribed by law. This is the exact wording that is used in Section 228. Now it is in our own rules as part. We proceed, Chair, to the National Assembly rules, which speaks to the functions of the Portfolio Committee. Such Rule 227 of the National Assembly rules provides for functions of portfolio committees. In particular, it states that a portfolio committee may monitor, investigate, inquire into, and make recommendations concerning such executive organ of state, constitutional institution, or other body or institution, including its legislative program, budget, rationalization, policies, or such organ of state institution or other body. Now again, you see the same words are being used in defining the functions of a portfolio committee, which is where the issue of duplication comes in. Now we proceed, Chair, to the rules of the NCOP. The rules of the NCOP are a little bit unclear in terms of the functions of the Select Committee. But what we will pick up was that for the purposes of performing its functions, a committee may, subject to the Constitution, legislation, and other provisions of the rules and resolution of the Council, summon any person to appear before it to give evidence on oath of affirmation or produce documents, including conducting of hearings. What we pick here, Chair, is that inasmuch as it does not use the same word as the NA rules, was that the Select Committee can call upon any person or organ of state. say, to account to it in respect of particular issues. And those particular issues can relate to budget, policies, legislative program, or any other matter that falls within an organ of state. Chair, in 19 and 20, which I'm not going to go into because it's a matter we have already touched on, we just looked at the law as prescribed by the court. In the S versus Parenting case, the court made it clear that any existing law continues to exist until it is specifically or expressly repealed, which is the case, which is not the case with Section 228. Now we proceed, Chair, to speak to what we think is the is the legal position, having looked at all the regulatory framework. The Constitution, which is the supreme law of the Republic, provides for the mandate of Parliament. It vests on the Parliament the power of function to exercise oversight over the executive. The Department of Defense falls within the realm of executive and is subject to the aforesaid oversight function of Parliament. Section 56 and 69 provide the power of Parliament and its committees. In this respect, the Portfolio Committee, Select Committee are given the power to summon persons to appear before it. The aforementioned power includes the power to investigate and make recommendation to the respective houses on any relevant matter, which could be the matters that overlap between the two committees. In paragraph 24, we say it is our considered view that the aforementioned duplication may at times result in an unnecessary duplication of efforts, which is an undesirable outcome, as correctly pointed out by the JSCD. It is important to note that while there may be a duplication, as noted above, the powers of the Joint Standing Committee, as set out above, remain in full force, pending repeal or amendment, as per the Constitutional Court decision in Parenting. In other words, we're saying we agree with the Joint Standing Committee that there is an overlap between these two committees. But we maintain that, as matters stand, legally speaking, Joint Standing Committee is a legal committee legislatively provided for. And we proceed then, Chair, to provide what we think should happen. There are two options that we see. The first option is to retain the status quo, in other words, retain the Joint Standing Committee as it is, but look into narrowing its mandate to focus on certain identified or defined functions so that it does not overlap with the other two committees. So in other words, it can focus, let's say, on investigation of whatever that happens within the Defence Force. And when we do that, we make sure that the other committees do not duplicate those functions. They focus on other issues. That's one option, Chair. In other words, you retain it as it is, but define or redefine the mandate to narrow it to specific issues. The second option, Chair, is to move for an amendment or repeal of, in fact, I think it should be a repeal of Section 228 of the Constitution. And completely remove the Joint Standing Committee. But Chair, then we need to say this. This is a policy decision. We advocate for no particular position. We just table the two positions which we think are feasible within the existing framework. But if it has to be repealed, it seems to us the best vehicle to do that would have been the Defence Act in 2002. When the Defence Act was passed by Parliament. But for some reason, that did not happen. So if it is to happen, I would suppose that the committee, through the Speaker, will have to engage the Minister of Defence, and the idea will have to be sold to her to initiate legislation that will repeal the section, or the committee can initiate a committee bill on its own. Those are the two options that the committee can, if the Department of Defence cannot be persuaded to do so. And then the Section 228 can be repealed. I think, Chair, those are the brief. I didn't read the entire opinion. I just focused on what I think is salient for the conclusion we reach. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Advocate Jigaila, for the briefing. I think in your summary, you have covered all the essential elements of your opinion. I think it sets us clear as to what is it that we should look at as a portfolio committee. Now, I'm now looking at the portfolio committee members. Honourable Moran.
Chair, just one question, and I'm not saying that because I say that I'm an expert in this field, but just on clarity. Nowhere you refer to Section 75 bills and 76 bills, and that normally indicates, you know, Section 75, what is that, and what is the impact on a national basis, and 76 is where it affects provinces, where we know that defence is only a national responsibility and not a provincial one. Does that not help us to indicate where what should lie? That's probably a new angle or a new question in terms of the responsibility of Parliament. When we approved an amendment to the Defence Act, it never gets sent to the NCOP for consideration because it's a 75 bill. Now our responsibility is also around 75 bills in terms of the portfolio committee. Does that not influence it as well? Because that sets up the function that we have to do. Those two indications. I'm just asking questions. That was a bit.
May I ask you to respond this because it's just a process point, Advocate.
Chair, it's correct. Section 75 bill are those bills that are ordinary bills, not affecting the provinces. So it will go through the NA, and it goes to the NCOP. Yes. So there is no issue there. They could go through both houses. But of course, because it does not necessarily affect the provinces, the power lies with the NA. Whatever the NCOP may propose may be overruled by the NA because of the nature of the bill, as opposed to a 76, where the NCOP has a bigger voice. So it will go, NA, once it's passed, it goes to the NCOP. So both houses must pass it.
I
don't know if
the answer. No, it does. I just want to whether that has got an impact on our question that we sit with. What should we do? And whether we should, you know, get any guidance from those two.
No, I think you are moving away from the substance of the legal opinion. Let's first check if we agree with the opinion as it placed before us. After that, we I think we leave it at that, because you just say we agree and then leave it at that, and we may have to pick it up at some other point, because we're not saying agree and that's it. Okay, we're saying agree in terms of understanding where things are, and then leave it at that for now, and we may decide at some point what we want to do. It's the duplication that was an issue. Thanks, Honourable Moran.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think the clarity that we were looking for is presented. And I think at the later stage, we might revisit, because one of the bills that went through the NA is the Defence End or something. It's coming. So this might assist us going forward, but for now, I think it's for us to note this recommendation because they provide the necessary clarity that we wanted. Thank you.
It's precisely, I mean, you raised the point that it is a policy matter. Now, it being a policy matter, it needs to be processed at that level. And that level is not this level. Right now, there's got to be consultation with the parties. That I was with our caucuses, so that we derive our mandate as to how we should move forward. But at least it assists us when we engage with our caucuses to say, this is the matter, and this is how it's being proposed. We should go about it, and let's discuss it. All right. That's the reason why I'm saying for us it suffices to you know to be clear on the issues as we have presented them. Now, I think Honourable Motle is raising a point. There's a defense, I can't remember, I saw a Defense Act Amendment bill. I'm not too sure if it is on its way to Parliament or it's past Parliament, is now at an NSOP level. And have you seen anything like that? Because he says if it is on its way to Parliament, maybe that would be an opportunity where we engage as advised, but after having consulted with our principals. And have you seen anything to that effect?
Yes, Chair, there is a bill that was introduced in the last term. I suspect it lapsed with the end of the fifth parliament. I'm not sure if it has been revived in the sixth parliament. I think somebody may have to check, but there was a bill that was introduced. It lapsed in the fifth.
I'm sure I've seen it yesterday on one of the ACTs, on Tuesday, where it was introduced and it has been need to be revived. Would that be a military discipline board?
Okay.
Oh, the hydrographic board.
No, they are talking about a different one. That is at the NCOP level. It's already passed through the NA. And then let me just recognize our PLO, Mr. Kabinde.
Thank you, Chair. The bill is with NA now. It was revived. Yeah, but when we requested the revival, we said it should be revived at the place where it ended. So the Defense Amendment Bill was with NA. The Hydrographic Bill is with NCOP.
Oh, I see. So it's within the NA process. All right. No, it's fine. We will have to look at it at some point. Sometimes I don't know what it's all about and how relevant it is to the issues that we are discussing at the moment. Okay? Colleagues, we are leaving it at that. At least we are clear. But we'll continue as if nothing has happened so far until there is a clear directive and a decision on the matter as to how we should move forward. All right. Now that we have concluded this on that note, can we then move to the next act? So it's going to take us through an analysis of the Military Veterans Act. Thank you so much. It's 2011 Act. Yeah. Yes, over to Lucas.
Thank you very much, Chair. Now I need to be careful, Chair, because the department is here and the general is sitting uncomfortably close to me. the request that we received was to advise.
At least you are separated by your colleague.
We were requested to advise on the interpretation of certain provisions of the Military Act, or Military Veterans Act. The full extent of the request is set out under the legal question, Chair. And we quote from your letter, Chair, to us, verbatim in paragraph 3, what the issues were that were raised with us. But, Chair, for the moment, I propose not to go through those issues because I will be jumping between the issue and the answer we provide. So maybe, but it's quoted in the opinion, all of the issues that were raised. So I propose just to proceed to the next page, where we emphasize that we are specifically requested to provide a legal interpretation of the background and the main objectives of the Act to evaluate whether it is justifiable to deal with these aspects in an amendment Act. As is evident from the above, and before I go to that paragraph 4, Chair, maybe I should say this. From the letter that you have addressed to us, What is evident was that this issue arises out of the annual report of the department. In particular, the department says it has worked hard to finalize an amendment bill of the Military Veterans Act. However, and this is a direct quotation, however, this process is delayed while the white paper is being drafted. So that is the context of the issues that were referred to us. In paragraph 5, Chair, we say, as is evident from the above, the questions posed to us go beyond, in certain respects, go beyond our competence, as they raise issues of policy which can be better dealt with by the department. For this reason, in this document, we will limit ourselves to advice on issues of legal interpretation of the relevant provisions of the Act. So, Chair, if at any point you feel that certain issues are not dealt with, it's because we consider them to be in the domain of policy, and they are better dealt between the committee and the Ministry of Military Veterans. Chair, we start with the Constitution, and I'm not going to read everything there, Chair, because I want to focus on what the mandate of Parliament vis-à-vis the Department is. Section 44 says the legislative authority of the Republic is vested in Parliament. And among the functions of Parliament is to pass legislation with regard to any matter. So in other words, you have the authority to amend any law or to pass a law. So the issue of amendment is perfectly within your authority as Parliament. And we proceed to 227, and I won't read it, Chair, because I've already dealt with 227 in the previous opinion. It sets out the powers of committees. In terms of the oversight role of the portfolio committee, the committee also exercises oversight over the Department of Military Veterans, including on the legislative program and policies. Chair, we are referring to a portfolio committee here because your request came from the portfolio committee, or at least that's the impression we got, that it was the portfolio committee, not the joint standing committee. Then we proceed to the Military Veterans Act, Chair. If you look at the long title of the Military Veterans Act, this is what it says. The Act intends to provide for principles recognized by the state as governing the affairs of military veterans and for policy objectives in this regard. And those principles, Chair, are set out in detail in the Act. Section 3 of the Act sets out broad fundamental principles recognized by the state and policies. So the principles that are set out, that are alluded to in the long title, are set out in Section 3 of the Act. In particular, Section 3.1c states that in the event of a military veteran or a category of military veterans being considered for possible non-contributory aid by the state, such military veteran or category of military veterans must be subjected to a means test to determine their eligibility. Section 24 of the Act empowers the minister to make regulations. Amongst the issues the minister can pass regulations on is the criteria that must be met in order to qualify for the benefit. Further to the above, Section 3.2g, now we are speaking to the principles we alluded to. It provides that any policy regarding the affairs of military veterans must contribute towards reconciliation and nation building. Chair, at this stage you may be confused why we thought this was important, because it relates to a specific question you asked, which we are going to now. And I will go back to your questions which we quoted. Your first question relates to Section 1, and I will be looking back and going forward just to deal with that sort of methodically. Section 1 defines the military veteran. The question was raised whether preference can be given, especially to members of or whose contracts were not renewed, such as military skills development members who wanted to claim benefits. That was the question that was put to us. Now you will see why the principles and the principle of reconciliation and nation building, why it was relevant for it to be mentioned in this context. If you look at the definition in Chapter 15, in paragraph 15 of the military veteran, it lists three categories of veterans. It's those between 1960 to 1994, what is referred to as the Liberation War. It says all the military organizations, statutory and non-statutory, which were involved on all sides of South Africa's Liberation War from 1960 to 1994. That's the first category. The second category is those who served in the Union Defense Forces before 1961. The third category is the new members of the South African National Defense Force after 1994. Those are the specific three categories that are listed in the section. Now, if you go back to the question whether this can be limited to only non-statutory force, theoretically, Chair, yes, it can be done. But that can only be done by means of an amendment to the Act. Now, there are two difficulties with that. The first difficulty is your principle under 3.2, which says any policy that is made with regard to military veterans must take into account the issues of nation building and reconciliation. That is the first hurdle that will have to be overcome. If you exclude certain categories of veterans, is that contributing to that principle? But again, Chair, that is a policy issue that amongst the members, it must be debated. The second challenge, Chair, that you will have with the narrowing of the definition is that from 2011, when the Military Veterans Act was passed, the categories of people you want to exclude now have, by virtue of the Act coming into operation, acquired rights under that Act. So even if we were to suppose that an amendment is effected, it seems to us that that amendment can only apply prospectively. In other words, it cannot take away the status of people who acquired the status of being a military veteran with effect from 2011. So if you pass that law on the 31st of October in 2019, it will apply from that date going forward. So the military veterans who have acquired vested rights by virtue of the 2011 Act will continue to be military veterans going forward in terms of the Act that was applicable at the time. That status cannot be taken away. Chair, we emphasize that it is clear from the wording of this definition that it was intentionally designed to be inclusive of all the forces. This is evident in the use of the phrase involved on all sides of South Africa's Liberation War from 1960 to 1994. And there may be a logic to 1960 to 1994, because that's when all the Liberation Armies were formed. I think MK was formed in 1961, APLA in 1961, AZANLA was formed a little bit later, but the Republic was also formed in 1961, the Republic of South Africa. So I think that's why there is that specific date going forward. This is reinforced by the specific reference to Union Defense Forces before 1961. This seems to accord with the fundamental principle captured in Section 3.2G that any policy regarding the affairs of military veterans must contribute towards reconciliation and nation building. It seems to us, Chair, that this was intentional for the purposes of reconciliation and nation building. The question of who must qualify, because this seems to be at the nub of the question, Chair. The question of who must qualify for benefits prescribed in Section 5 of the Act is regulated through a means test, referred to in Section 3.1c of the Act. Section 3.1c provides for a means test to determine the eligibility for benefits. For means test, the means test is prescribed for in the military regulations of 2011 issued under Government Gazette 37355/2011. In particular, the criteria is set out in regulations 12, 13, 14, and 16. The SL regulations as currently crafted do not give preference to any specific category, as the means test is of general application to all military veterans. As such, any preferential treatment, and I need to emphasize, any preferential treatment under the existing legislation will fall foul of the Act and the regulations. It is instructive, Chair, to look at Section 2 of the Act, which provides that this Act must not be interpreted as entitling any person who is defined as a military veteran in this Act or his or her dependents to any benefit provided for in this Act or any other law merely on the grounds of such definition. So the concern that is there, by virtue of you fitting within the definition of a military veteran, that does not automatically entitle you to a benefit. You have to pass the means test. And that cuts across all the three categories of veterans. You could be in the NSF, but you could fail the means test because you earn more than 150. I think that's the provision in the regulation. So there is that provision. You could be in the former SADF, pass the means test. You could retire from the SANDF after 1994. You could not qualify. So this means that cuts across because it's of general application at the moment, unless the Act is amended to provide for what is sought, which is a policy issue that must be debated. Chair, I will now proceed to the question that relates to Section 5I and J, which relates to health care. The question that was posed was, why is it that the provision for health care and housing is specific to a military veteran? What about the widows and widowers and their children once the beneficiary has passed away? Section 5.1 of the Act provides a list of benefits relating to military veterans. Section 5.2 extends the benefits to the dependents of a military veteran. But what is interesting is that the extension to dependents is limited to certain benefits. The benefits that are extended to dependents is counseling, is education, training, and skills development, and its pension. This, Chair, in our view, is a clear demonstration that the legislature intended to limit the benefits to the dependents to the three that are mentioned in that section. And unfortunately, health care, housing, and pension are not included in that. So it seems that looking at the scheme of the Act, it was deliberate that certain benefits are extended, but not the rest. So, Chair, again, we're saying if the committee feels that that policy needs to be changed, that can only be achieved by means of an amendment to the Act. But as the Act stands, there are only three benefits that are extended to the dependents and not the others. Chair, I will proceed. And the same, Chair, applies to the issue of housing. In respect of 5J, we add that where a house has already been allocated, which is the interesting part, the question is, why is it that the housing is not extended to dependents again? And our view, Chair, is these benefits are primarily for military veterans, not dependents. And I think that's why a bigger chunk of them is reserved for veterans, and only three are extended to their beneficiaries. But we express a view which may not be determinative of the issue. We express a view that if a house has already been allocated to a veteran and he passes on or she passes on, that house, because it's a vested right, it will form part of the estate and it can devolve to the dependents. But if it has not been allocated, there is no right that dependents can claim in the absence of a military veteran. That's how we interpret that section. Section 5K also speaks to housing, which is I've just addressed. Section 7 speaks to the issue of National Military Veterans Association. And the question that we were asked is whether we were asked on the issue of funding of the National Military Veterans Association. Chair, Section 26 of the Act provides that the costs and expenses connected with the administration and implementation of this Act must be defrayed from monies appropriated by Parliament to the Department for that purpose. So in other words, you can only use the budget of the Department for administration and implementation of this Act. But the Act creates or establishes the National Military Veterans Association. So in our view, it is a statutory body established in terms of the Act. So any expenses relating to that should be fundable from the budget of the department. So we opine that the National Military Veterans is a statutory body established in terms of the Act and is required to advise both the minister and the DG on matters affecting the military veterans. As such, we are of the opinion that these activities are related to administration and implementation of the Act. It is the function that is created by the Act itself, and therefore may, subject to available resources, be funded from the budget of the department. Notwithstanding that opinion which we expressed, Chair, we advise that the accounting officer of the department will be the better judge of what is the administration and implementation of the Act, despite our own opinion that the National Military Veterans Association is a statutory body. So it is difficult for us to answer that question in the abstract. Section 9 to 18, Chair, again speaks to the issue of military council. I mean of the Military Veterans Advisory Council. In terms of Section 10 of the Act, the role of the Advisory Council is to advise the Minister and the Director General on policy applicable to military veterans and all matters pertaining to military veterans. According to a dictionary.com, the word advise is a verb meaning to give counsel, offer an opinion, or suggestion as word following. From that definition of the English word advise, it is clear that the minister is under no obligation to follow the advice. It is a recommendation which the minister must consider. But we qualify that change, and we say this, however, does not mean the minister is at liberty to ignore sound advice without good reason. She is required by the principle of rationality to at least demonstrate that she has considered the advice. Any other interpretation would have the effect of rendering the council superfluous, contrary to the clear intentions of the legislature. Inasmuch as it is advice or a recommendation or a suggestion, but the law requires that you demonstrate that you have applied yourself and for a good reason you have decided not to. Otherwise, the council becomes unnecessary if it's going to be ignored in all its ways. From the reading of Section 20, now we're speaking to the Military Veterans Appeal Board. And again, the question here relates to whether they are merely advising the minister or the minister has to follow the decisions of the appeals board. From the reading of Section 20 of the Act, it will appear that the appeal board has both adjudicative and advisory powers. And this is clear from Section 21A and Section 21C respectively. We are fortified in this view by the provisions of Section 22 of the Act. in as far as the adjudicative powers of the appeal board, the board may confirm, set aside, or vary a decision contemplated in subsection 1A. These are the exact words from the legislation. The board may confirm, set aside, or vary a decision contemplated in subsection 1. This clearly gives the board the power to make a binding decision. But at the same time, the Act gives it an advisory role as well to the minister. In other words, the department will not be under any obligation to follow those. But one needs to distinguish the adjudicative power where it set aside or confirm or vary the decision. To this end, it would appear that the decision of the board in this regard would be binding on the department. In conclusion, Chair, we make the point which I made earlier that to the extent that the questions posed by the committee hint at a policy shift, we will advise the committee to engage the department with a view to persuade it to consider the relevant amendments which the committee deems necessary. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much, colleagues. The matter has been summarized. The questions that this legal opinion purports to address is just a summary of the questions that arose in our meetings. And we thought they needed these questions to assist in the drafting and recalibrating the opinion. I think it has achieved that purpose. The opinion is very clear, and I now put it on the table for discussion, colleagues. Is there any question of clarity or comment before we close on the matter? And the idea was to, you know, make us understand the legal framework we are operating within, insofar as this issue is concerned. And I thought it was necessary that we take in the presentation and the presence of the Department of the Military Veterans, so that both ourselves and themselves are on the same page, insofar as matters military veterans are concerned. And their colleagues, Mr. Shalem, Ms. Motise.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I remember correctly, that question emanates from one, I think, of the meetings when we came in the 6th Parliament, where there were concerns about the issue of the SDU and SPUs. That do they not, form part of the military veterans? Are they not being considered to be part of? Also, the issue of the South African Cape Corps. Now, I'm checking now, looking to the three, categories that you have mentioned, that what is going to happen now? Does that mean now we need to be clear enough to explain to the people, because these people from the SPUs and SDUs are still not considering themselves to be part of that. And on the question of the South African Cape Corps, well, I think there was an answer that was given on that page. But I'm just thinking now, you as a chair, what is going to happen to ensure that information is cascaded and they know, so that they don't have any forces outside who will be saying, we want, to be, if, they are not part in that, a category. Thank you.
I think what Mr. Shalem is asking, in refreshing his memory, is whether, in other words, in short, who constitutes the non-statutory force or forces, and how far does it go? Does it go to extend the elements that he has spoken about, or is limited to certain forces? Maybe let's put it that way. I now throw it back at you before we I take it forward. Because as for the statutory forces, it's clear. Okay, sure, thanks.
Chair, I think this is a very slippery slope for me. It seems it's a polycentric question, Chair, which perhaps should be going to my left. Because those specific categories that we have just quoted now do not appear in the Act. It is a very slippery slope, Chair, for a legal advisor to dabble in that. I will defer to the department. Mine was to interpret the law as it stands, and I think I've done justice to that. Thank you, Chair. I have to decline this one.
No, thanks. Generally, may I assist? You understood the question. Over to you, sir.
Thanks, Chair. And good day, Honourable Members. The issue of the SDUs and SPUs, in terms of them having participated, that can be confirmed by the political organization whether they did participate or not and at what stage. And therefore, if they must be taken on board, somebody must be able to say, this individual was trained, either internally, and he was part of this organization, and he has done A, B, C, D, then he must be confirmed. Then the question would be, if then they were SDUs, are they military veterans, or can they be assisted and supported in another way? I won't be able to say from where I'm seated. Thanks, Chair.
Does it answer your question, Shalem?
Yeah, well,
I think what he has said, well, is acceptable because he just came on to explain who, qualifies in terms of the Act. But, you see, that's why on our side, you know, as a committee, we have that concern from outside where people are saying we are part of the liberation movement, but internally, not, like those, of the MK, APLA, you know, but they still, arguing that they do, qualify to be declared as the one of the non-special forces at that time. But I understand, the background of what is being said.
No, it's fine. Let's leave it at that for now. And because the legal opinion was confined to what the law is, what the law says at this point in time. And probably the matter will pursue in terms of discussion going forward. But I think that suffices for purposes of this, because it's the definition is there, and then it moves from the definition right through to the end of the section. Is there any other comment? Oh, Ms. Montese, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chair.
Well covered. Right. Okay. So I think, Advocate, you have done your job very well. Now we are clear on where we stand insofar as the Act is concerned. And you may leave whenever you want to. And we'll then move from this item now. On that note, to take the second item. And the second item is on the skills audit and the database management by the Department of Military Veterans. Colleagues, the research document prepared by Dr. Jan van Rensburg will assist your colleagues in refreshing your memory. The discussions that have gone into this since 2017. So if you look at page 2 of the document, is the BRRR recommendation related to the database 2017. There's a mention 2018 BRRR, there's another mention, and 2019 BRRR is also another mention, and that relates to the database. And on the skills audit is found on page 3 of this document, and the recommendations related to the skills audit were found, as I mentioned, in the 2016 BRRR, 2017 BRRR, another mention, and 2018 BRRR, another mention. That is if you want to refresh your memory. And now hand over to the department. Over to you, General.
Thanks, Chair. With your permission, Chair, then we will probably start with the skills audit and the presentation. Next slide. We'll cover, Chair, the definition of what a skills audit is, and also we have just that it's have to look back in terms of the organogram or structure which was approved, and of course also tend to visit the issue of the vacant posts within the department, because those will be speaking to the performance of the department, which will be in fact quite clear when we begin to look at the issue of the analysis of the outcome, audit outcomes. And we'll look at the introduction and the approach adopted, progress, where are we, and we'll conclude. Next slide. Chair, honourable members, if we look at the definition as found in the Skills Women Act number 98 of 1998 as amended, it speaks to a process that can be used to identify the skills gap in an organization. The outcome is a training needs analysis that identifies where training is needed. So you identify a gap. Once you know what the gap is, then you can develop a program speaking to individuals in terms of empowering them so that they can close the gap. Now, the GMV, therefore, has got a structure which was approved with post and post profiles. The blue stars which are indicated there just indicate the posts which are vacant in terms of the organization as we speak. Check. Now, those posts, first of all, the structure was approved in 2010 by the Minister of Public Service Administration, and presently the post of the Director General is vacant. The post of the Deputy Director General of Social Economic Support is vacant. The other one, which is not necessarily reflected there, is another Deputy Director General. Corporate Services is also vacant. Chief Director, Beneficiary Support, that's what it speaks to the database, is also vacant. Director, HR, is vacant. And then GITO, Director, is also vacant. That speaks to information technology. Now, if one then looks at all that and probably some of the reason why there's been a need and a call for skills audit of the department, looking at the outcomes of the audit of the department by the AG. 2013-14 financial year, the audit outcome was a disclaimer. The following two financial years, we were qualified. It is only from 16-17 up to the last financial year, which unqualified, of course, with findings. Then obviously, therefore, our performance as a department have led to the question, do we really have the set of skills required to run a department in terms of the employees of the department? Next slide. So this is probably what has been covered in the first bullet in terms of Parliament was concerned with the level of performance within the department as depicted in the outcome. So if we begin to at least analyze that, it becomes quite clear that in terms of capacity and capability and our function as a department, both at strategic and operational level, there is a challenge and that creates a risk. Therefore, the management in terms of knowledge of available skills available within the department, we could not even ourselves, in fact, conduct the skills audit. So we then had to outsource even the function to do that determination in terms of what is available and what is the gap. So the approach we have followed, Chair, Honourable Members, we had to find a service provider through the supply chain management, and that was done. And then in 2016, the process was then kick-started, which led to a contract being signed in 2017, December. And the scope and the issues which were going to be covered, we were speaking to the employees, identifying employee skills and compare them with the requirements as per the department in terms of the post profile as we are and probably for the future, and then determine what are the gaps if there are any, and of course those who might have at least a strong position. And then once the gap has been identified in terms of the individual profile and the profile of the post which is occupied by the person, then there'll be a need, at least in terms of training, that would lead to a training program or a human resource development program. And this was supposed to have been started in January 2018 and finished by May 2018. That was the schedule in terms of doing this skills audit. And the employees we were estimating at the time was about 250 employees. Next slide. So the employees, once that was done, in fact, immediately we had a contract, we had also to look at the issue of the service level agreement with the service provider. And then once that service level agreement was in place, then the employees were assessed, and there are reports which speak to the individual assessment. And as a management, we are looking at those assessments of individuals. And once they are done from the HR perspective, then they will be presented to the DMV senior management for consideration, which then also there might be, which we're looking very strongly at, question of also interacting with the service provider to ensure that we finalize the process going forward and as based on the agreed protocol. We accept, Chair, that this is very critical because where we are seated now from the 16, 17, 18, 19, it's quite clear that we are not progressing even to begin to improve our audit outcomes. So at this stage, this is where we are sitting. Once we are done as management, we'll be able to have a report which says this is the situation, and then we'll be able to bring to the committee. Thanks, sir.
All right. Thank you so much, colleagues. Honourable Mwanse.
Thanks, Chair. You have given us guidance in terms of the document that is can engage with the presentation. But if you look at that particular document you referred to, from 2016, the report was expected by the then committee, and it was not submitted the subsequent years. And to date, the presentation says the department is in consultation with the service provider to ensure finalization of that particular process. So I don't know, even if we want to engage, what are we going to engage on? What the department must do, must finalize the process and bring the report so that we engage the report. For now, there's nothing for us to engage. Maybe what we can do, we must give them timeline to bring that report because it has been long overdue. 2016 they committed, 17, 18 is now end of 19. They must also encompass this reasons why it taken them for so long for them to complete the entire process. I mean, it's an exercise that they could have completed within a year, but we are on the third, if not the fourth year, third year since the process has started. I thank you, Chair.
I note that, Honourable Motler. Let me hear what Honourable Shalem has to say. Thanks. And Honourable Murray.
No. Chairperson, to concur with Umotle, you know, I was looking that on the presentation or progress of the presentation that the outcome would be presented to the DMV senior management for consideration. Now, given that, you know, there's no time frame, when is that? At least, you know, if there is a time frame to say this will be presented to the DMV, when? Is nothing. I don't know whether there is any possibility. I mean, to give us the time frame on that.
Yeah. Thanks, Honourable Murray.
Thank you, Chair. General, this concern that my colleagues has raised, is that a man-made problem or a challenge, or is it a system problem? Because I remember from previous years, we've always talked about a computerized system and a database. Now, if it's only a man-made, then you can whip, you know, you use the whip and you can chase them. But if it's a system problem, and if, for instance, CETA is involved with regards to the system and the computerized system, it might be a total different ball game and different challenges, and then it might be maybe unfair to put the pressure on the warm bodies, if I can use that phrase. So to what extent has that been dealt with, or is that still a problem? Because we complain on a yearly basis about the database. That is never up to date, and it's always a challenge. And whenever an MV, a military veteran, approached the department or us eventually, they always say, you know, it's just like a impossible task to get yourself registered, and once you are registered, to get verification and then eventually to get benefits. So to what extent is that part of it, and what was done about that?
May I suspend that part of the question, Mr. Murray, because it's right now we're dealing with the skills audit. Yes, it is coming. Are you going to take us through that brief? Yeah, they will take us through just an update, Mr. Murray, on how they are doing. They are dealing with the database. Remember, we gave them until the end of the year to come back to us with a clarified database.
Yeah.
So it's just a progress report.
The database we can proceed, but in terms of the skills audit,
yeah, okay.
But it's still a computerized system as well. Thank you.
No, that's fine on that one. All right, colleagues. I mean, the colleagues, they're saying the gestation period has been too long. Even the elephant, the period is 22 months. Here is 3 years. But we note what you have
saying on page on page 11 of your document, that you are still assessing the report, that you are analyzing the assessment reports, one. Two, once that done, the outcome of that process will be presented to the DMV senior management for consideration. And thirdly, you will then, you know, consult with the consultant to finalize the process, and thereafter take the issue forward. We note that. And so I think the honourable member was saying how soon how long will that process take to conclude, to bring it to its finality? Because it's critical for the functioning of the department.
Thanks. In terms of the GMV senior management, we have looked at November the 25th, because that's where the executive room is sitting. So we have given an opportunity to management from the HR side to compile that and make sure that it's ready for presentation on the 25th of November. So this is where we'll be engaging the actual report. And then once then we know, because at least it indicates in terms of the development areas of the individual, the strong areas of the individual, and the also the recommendation made. So we'll be able to then have a sense of what it says per individual. So this is what they are preparing for this discussion. Thank you.
And I'm sure it answers both yourself, Mr. Mutler, and Mr. Shalem. Do you still want to make a follow-up, Mr. Mutler?
Not necessarily a follow-up. It's a timeline. Can we give them up until the end of this their financial year? They must have presented to us that particular report.
We want to see you start the new financial year on a clean slate. So we can only be assured that you're on a clean slate after you have given us the outcome of your assessment of your skills audit. Would you agree to that?
There is no option, Chair, because once we know the report and we've got a sense of what the gap is and the quality of the report, and then we are able at least to look at the program of the individuals, then we should be able to say by the end of the financial year, we should be able to explain ourselves.
No, we'll slot a meeting somewhere between February and March, just to get an update. Okay, February and March, I call it February, March, to get an update on their readiness to start the new year with a finalized process on their skills audit. All right, so that's how we conclude this item. And there was an issue that was raised by Mr. Mare. I think, Mare, the skills audit was done by the consultant, who has since submitted the report to the department. The department is processing the report, so that it's taken too long for them to finalize the report.
Yes, I accept that, but my question was just with regards to whether it was just a man-made, in other words, a human problem, or whether it's a system problem as well. And if it's a system problem where CETA must be involved, then we obviously have got an obligation to follow on with CETA as well. So that was just my question.
I don't think the CETA would be involved because it was done by consultant. In other words, it's what occasioned the delay? Was it related to them having access to the system?
Or whether the system is not functional?
Or whether the system itself wasn't assisting in their consult, in their work as consultants?
Richard, it was not F-16 perception, because you are talking to the post profiles and the individual's qualification, and then based on that, the service provider agency couldn't at least go through. But as for the department per se, we were, in fact, the reason why we went outside is because we don't have the capacity or the capability to do that as a department. Thank you. In terms of the human element side of it.
So then leave it at that until February, March, where we ask you, we invite you back to give us the progress report on the skills audit. All right. I think that even before it receives a negative opinion from the AG. All right? All right. That being the case, can we quickly then move to the database? We are aware that here is work in progress, General, and that we've given you until the end of the year to come back to us with a purified database. And we just need to get just an update, the quick highlight, and then we close it at that. Thanks.
Next slide. That's the scope which is going to be covered. Chair, next slide. And the purpose of today, just to update in terms of progress, the Joint Standing Committee on Defence. Next slide. Chair, I think we won't be going down to the issue of the Act, except that the Act expects us as a department to have in place a credible and secure database. That's what the Act says. And of course, the origin of the name list without problem of the people who find themselves in that database comes from the integration process itself, where the commanders were expected to produce the certified personnel register. With then those, that list is available within the DOD. And since the DOD then has been there, and part of the affairs of the military veterans were run within the HR environment, the information which then had to migrate to create DMV had to move from DOD, one of the territories, and that was the challenge. And in 2003, just to give a sense, is that then there was beginning to have an outcry from those who did not integrate and who did not demand. So they were not necessarily available anyway. So they were beginning to ask for inclusion. Hence, then the department in 2013, when it was created, and also there were benefits, then quite a number of people started servicing, asking to be brought on board so that they can benefit in terms of the benefits as explained.
Just on that point, Mr. Shilembre, for you to become a military veteran, you must have gone through this process. You must have been integrated, integrated or demobilized. If you have not been not been to either of the two, you must then be picked up by the system that now I think is talking to how they are now picking up on those who were missed out during this process, during the demobilization and the integration process.
Once then this outcry, if you said quite a number of people were coming out, then the department in 2013 decided that they are going to put up a verification process, where then the mainly it was from the NSF. Then the commanders and the association were then mandated to begin to do something in relation to verify the individuals. Next slide. Now, what then has happened, I think the slide speaks exactly to that in terms of the CPR list, SADF list, and then finally we then had to look at those who were integrated, and then those who were not integrated, those who did not demobilize. The verification process should, among others, check itself. So what we're looking for, Chair, is that Now, if you are not in the CPR list,
say it in full, that acronym is CPR.
If you are not in this certified personal register list, then you've got to be confirmed by those who trained you, and at least what, and you also have to mention the people you trained with. And if you conducted operation, then you must be able to say you conducted operation with who, and then who was your commander. Then those individuals in this process are expected to put that in writing and provide at least in terms of an affidavit, and also the copies of their IDs must also be available, so that we can be able to have a sense of the department, where do you come from, and of course, how have you missed for almost 25 years or so to be part of the process. So these are the issues which we are looking at. Next slide. Now, we were also just in this trying to indicate that in this slide, the portfolio committee did ask us the similar question in the past, and we also at least tried to explain ourselves that there's a tool which we are using, but we are trying to enhance that tool. And we are working with CETA to make sure that that database is secure and is credible. And we have lately also interacted with the DoD ICT infrastructure and their application system, because that's where, in fact, the origin of the list we have is coming from. And we are engaging also the cybersecurity division of AMSCO when we're beginning to look at how can we secure the database once we're done with the cleansing of that database. And with the Department of Home Affairs, we are working with them simply because most of us, we've got IDs, and then those IDs and the information which is there in the and the information we're looking for, not only the ID of the person, but the address of the person, and also the if you are married, and your partner, and also if you've got children, as they are dependents, they also reflected there. So this would help us in terms of trying to make sure that the people we're talking to and the ones which we're saying in the database are South Africans, and the ones they claim to be their dependents are really their dependents. So this is why we're engaging Department of Home Affairs. As for the presentation which was made in terms of the senior post, there is that chief directorate. It's been advertised. Now it's a question of shortlisting and make sure that chief director comes on board, because it's critical that this is properly maintained. Next slide. Without prolonging the process, Chair, we have now, from August, started at least working with the Department of Defense, Home Affairs, and the other organization. What we received from DOD was about 86,000 people, out of 76,000, whose address were quite clear, whose ID were quite clear, whose contact details were quite clear, but the rest out of that 76,000 was not clear. And this is what then we're trying to achieve, when say we're cleansing the database also, we're trying to get. Now, we then organized about, or we took about 4,000 names of the people and their information to the DOD in August for them to process and be able to give us the kind of information we're looking for. And out of that, they were able to update about 38,638, that's about 98%. So in essence, therefore, as we speak, we're able to say about 72,000 of the military veterans in terms of their information has been updated. We've got a sense who they are. But we are not only ending with that one. We have, next slide. We have taken out the whole list of the military veterans, including the ones that 72,000, we have given them to Home Affairs. We said to Home Affairs, from the Department of 51st, this is what we have. This is what they are telling. Can then Home Affairs confirm what Defence Force is telling us in terms of their own system and their own files? And then Home Affairs is going through that. And
so that list will not include those who were demobilized.
We are trying to take everybody in terms of those, because now those who were demobilized might be there, Chair, because now as military veterans.
From the DOD list.
From the DOD list. So we're taking them. But now also what is becoming quite clear in our interaction with the Home Affairs, some of the individuals have passed on. So, but it's not yet complete. And of course some of the IDs, they are beginning to indicate a challenge in terms of gender of the individual. So we're beginning to find it difficult to understand. The individual appears to us to be a male, but according to Home Affairs, it's appearing that to be a female. So these are the things which we are handling with the Department of Home Affairs. Next slide. I think I'll be repeating myself in terms of the Department of Home Affairs, Arms Corps, DOD, SETA, mainly looking at the technology part of it, because once we've cleaned the names of the people and their dependents and everything else, still that information is not going to be secured. So anything can happen. And therefore the integrity is going to be in question. This is why therefore in terms of the technologies which are required to do what we want to do in terms of securing the database, we're engaging the departments we've just mentioned. And we've got at least some MOUs and SLAs with them to make sure that at least there's something which binds us and guides us going forward. What we've also done, Chair, is that there are individuals already benefiting and we're paying for that. And in terms of management of the documentation, we've been having a problem that sometimes when the AG is looking for file of somebody, it's difficult to find the file because of how we administer the individual. So we've created a project again which is putting up management of documentation and creating one file for a military veteran, including the dependent. And we're checking mainly those who are benefiting, because that is going to assist us. But now those files, because they are more in advance than this project, we're taking these files to this project so that this project can integrate the whole web going forward. Then that would be the issue of the cleansing of the database, and this is where we are before we go to the actual verification. Now the cleansing of the database, we are at least of the view, Chair, that we should be working with Home Affairs and with the other sister departments. Things being equal, we should be done by end of December in terms of cleaning the database. Securing it might be something different in terms of the technology required. But then, that's the database itself. The individuals who did not integrate, who then realized that there is DMV, their benefits, who started, as you say, coming up and applying, then presently we've got files, and which that process which one mentioned in 2013, in 2016. Now we've got files sitting up in the department, about 4,108 of those files, of those individuals. Now what we have done then in the department, there was not necessarily a mechanism to verify this, so we call this a verification process. And we put up two committees to deal with this, which are DMV committees. One does the verification under the chairmanship of the director who's sitting just behind me, who's running that. Then the other one is a review committee, because once one has been verified in terms of the file and the file passes the test, then the person goes to the database. But once it's declined, it automatically goes to the review committee. Then the review committee looks at that, and if it's declined, then the communication goes direct to the individual and the association where the individual comes from. so that it is as complication as we move forward. Now we've created therefore a checklist for the both review committee and the verification committee, where they're supposed to fill that form of the DMV. There is a form to fill which requires quite a number of things. And one of those things which is required is one's ID. And then also, if you have worked for MK, APLA, then there must be a service certificate. So also that's required so that it's signed by your commander. And you also give us a biography. Then the biography, once we go through it, it will indicate where you've been and what you have done. And as it was indicated in terms of those three affidavits, that's one of the things which is critical for any file that to pass the test, that must be there. And it must be endorsed by the commanders and those who train with. Next slide. Now, of course, some of the things is just out of our own being creative, Chair, where we're beginning to look in terms of the age of the person. We're saying that if in 1994 you were younger than 15 years, then we'll find it difficult for you to start applying because then that's 94 plus 15 years gives you something like 40 years. So if you want to be a military veteran at the age of 35, then we'll put a question mark. So it's going to be kind of a challenge. Part of the things you need to explain is where you trained, who trained you, you trained with who commanded you, operational experience if you've got any, and if you've been working, where have you been working this now, and why have you not integrated when you had all the time in the world or to register for all these years. And of course the question of approval or not approval, that would be what is done. And then it will be captured if it's approved. Then we think the project itself, Chair, in terms of this verification of this 4,108 members, should close by March. And we are also communicating with the association and everybody else that from now on, if you are not in, we will close it forever. But whether we'll succeed in terms of saying we close it forever, it's something else, but that's the intention, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Colleagues, the matter is now on the table for discussion, and I seem to be, I think you are making progress. I mean, from the last time we had a discussion on this, it's now clear that we will finally have a purified database at least before the end of this financial year. And the Nkosi, Honorable Nkosi, Nkosi.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like maybe to throw back, Gerard, on the issue in the background, as you stated, the issue of integration and demobilization. Just one question I wanted just to raise, Chairperson. I understand in the former Transkei there was an attempt of overthrowing government of General Holomisa, and there were soldiers there who were arrested. They were tried, but some were not found guilty, and they were released. If one may ask Gerard, what category do you sort of give those soldiers who happen to be on that side? Understand the honesty and dishonesty amongst the issues that have been raised in some of the documents of the department. Currently, some are crying foul that they were sort of thrown out of the whole system. They can't sort of even get what they were owed by the state at the time, because actually when there was unification of all the forces, they should have been given their due from the day they were employed as soldiers up to the day maybe they were found not guilty by the courts of law during those days. Thank you.
Yeah,
Thank you so much, Nkosi Qabekulu. Over to you, Honourable Mutle.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I just want to find out, in terms of closing the database, will you not be contravening the Act as per the interpretation that has been given now? Because we have three folds of categories that you need to cater as veterans. And even those that joined after 1994. Now, when you close the database, what are you saying about that particular fundamental legislative point? Will you not be contradicted by closing? That will be the answer. But on the verification committee, Roman figure 5, where you say three affidavit, two former combatant, and then one commander. In case where the commander is no more, how are you handling with the situation? That kind of a situation, because we cannot assume that all commanders that have fled are still there. Thank you.
Any other question? All right. A question for myself. The Act, General Envisage, is the creation of, I think it's Section 20 of the Act, of the appeals, what they call it, I'll tell you now, it's an appeal board. What is the relationship between the appeal board as envisaged in the Act and the review committee? One. Two, whether the advisory council has in fact been established, the advisory council envisaged by Section 18 of the Act, whether it has been established. I'm raising this because these two bodies have some role to do with the work of the Military Veterans Department. Thanks. Over to you.
Thanks, sir. Now you have put me under difficult position when then I'm going to say Honorable Nkosi.
Nkosi Qabekulu.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of one being a military veteran, first of all, one serving in uniform, you must have a clean record. That's the basis. But if then you've been discharged dishonorable, then you don't qualify, I suppose the Act says. But then if finally you then appeal your dismissal and then you are found not guilty, then I think then that would be taken on board. I won't be able to argue unless one knows the individual I'm talking to. I'm just speaking to the principle in this, that if there are people who were dismissed because of what they did in terms of the military being understood to be dishonorable, then they don't qualify. But then if they were cleared by a court of law, then they do qualify, because at the end of the day, that would be the decision of the court, would have to be respected. I'll leave it at that. I'm not quite sure that it makes sense. Then in terms of the database, it's not that we are closing the database. We are talking about the verification. Those who are sitting outside now, who are trying to apply to be in the database, mainly who are coming from the NSF, we are saying to the NSF members, between now and March next year, if you are sitting out there, this is an opportunity. Let's do this once and for all. And that's the idea. So as to make sure that there is nobody who's coming from the NSF, but even those who are in the CPR list who might not have registered in the database are expected to register. But it would be difficult to continue allowing people to sit outside and then coming in. That's the idea, to deal only with this verification. But coming in, if you are serving in the SAE in year, and then you come in, it will always continue in terms of restructuring. But the verification process, that's what we're trying to close.
Sure.
In terms of the commander, we accept that the commander might be have passed on. I think we had a case of a commander which was born in one of these cases we're looking at. But it was interesting when the other two members who train with the individual are able to collaborate that they were commanded by this person. And also then we managed to find other commanders who were with that commander at that stage. So once the commander is passed on, we just check and verify with those who were trained with the person or commanded whether this person in fact did exist and whether he was a commander at that stage. So we are absolutely set to do that. In terms of the review committee, this is the appeals board chair, that we, the appeals board is when the individual who is not satisfied with the decision of the department goes to the appeals board. We are trying to prevent that because we are saying that there will be a verification committee. But if it says no, before we even tell the individual that it has said this work must go to the review, to review this decision internally, so that internally there's a senior person who can take a final decision, even if the individual does appeal to the appeals board, because it is after the review board, if it was rejected by the verification committee, one will know whether it's been rejected or not when the review committee has said and then communicated that no, you don't qualify. Then the person will take it to the appeals board. In terms of the advisory council, they are more on the advising us, but again, the DG of the department is an ex-officio member of the advisory council. So in terms of sharing and sitting with the advisory council, in terms of policy and discussion, the DG of the department is always there. So they say sharing of information. Thanks.
Colleagues, thank you very much. That takes us to the end of the presentation and the discussion thereof. May I then thank you, DG, for Honourable General for your presentation. At least it certainly assures us that you are in the right step in terms of step towards finalizing the database. And with that, colleagues, the bell has rung, and they were expected to be in the house at 12 o'clock. And thank you very much, DG and the team.
Thanks, Chair. If we don't see each other before Christmas, allow me to say Merry Christmas and a prosperous New Year. See you in 2020. Thank you, Chair. Welcome.
Thanks.